This is Democracy Optimist. Here's your host, Professor Joshua Douglas of the University of Kentucky Rosenberg College of Law.
Welcome to Democracy Optimist, where we bring you the good, the bad, and the ugly on voting rights and election law with a dose of hope sprinkled in. 2020 saw unprecedented attacks on the results of the presidential election, even though there was no evidence whatsoever to question its results. It wasn't just January 6th. There was a sustained attempt to quite literally overturn the election result from November through January. There were legal memos about how to exploit the Constitution and federal law to change the outcome. Could that happen again in 2024? To answer that question, today we are speaking with Professor Lawrence Lessig of Harvard Law School. He's the author, with Matthew Seligman, of a new book titled How to Steal a Presidential Election. Larry, welcome to Democracy Optimist.
Thanks for having me.
So first, your book has a really provocative title, How to Steal a Presidential Election. You know, some might criticize you for providing a roadmap for the next attempted coup, and you do address this in Chapter 1. But tell us, why write a book that outlines just how to do it?
Well, I think what we saw in 2020 is that it's actually very complicated to understand what the rules are and how to apply them properly, because we actually saw that the rules were not being applied properly in 2020 on January 6th. Kentucky has a senator, Rand Paul, who I think was unique among Republicans, and Mitch McConnell was the same, but was very clear about the inappropriateness of questioning the votes from states like the state of Pennsylvania. You might have views about whether Pennsylvania counted their votes correctly or not. You might have views about whether the absentee ballots should have been included or not. Those views are perfectly appropriate. Have them however you want. But the Constitution only gives Congress the power to count the votes. And the Electoral Count Act is quite clear that if the votes have been tallied in, if the electoral votes have been cast in a way that's regular, there's no coercion or bribery, and the process is completed 6 days before the electoral votes are to be counted or cast, then Congress has no power to question the results. Now, we think that might have been that those members just were not being honest about what the law required, or that it's just so complicated that even the press didn't quite understand what the law required. And so I think we thought, Matt and I thought, that this really is something we ought to get the conversation going months in advance, so that by the time we get to the election and Electors Day and January 6, 2025, then in the culture, at least there's an understanding of what could go wrong and what we have to defend against, so that we can get a result that we have some confidence in.
Yeah, and you mentioned that Federal Electoral Count Act. You know, we're both law professors, and teaching this statute is almost impossible just to teach it to our students, to go through word by word. You know, most statutes, or many statutes, are complicated, but this one is out of the parks in terms of how convoluted it is. Now, you imagine a scenario in the book where the election between Biden and Trump is extremely close, and your hypothetical is that Trump wins the popular vote, but Biden wins the Electoral College, and the results in a state like North Carolina are put into question, or are very close to put into question. So why is that the right recipe? Why is that what we should be worrying about?
Well, I think that what 2020 actually showed us is that if the results are not actually close, and 2020 was not close compared to 2000, then we think the system holds. So, you know, even very partisan actors like Governor Kemp and Raffensperger, Secretary of State Raffensperger in Georgia, who were deeply committed to President Trump, felt like they had to do the right thing. And they had to do the right thing because there was no plausible basis for them to actually think anything other than what they said was the result. But if things are extremely close, and there are a lot of questions about whether the vote was properly administered, whether certain ballots should be counted, maybe there's a concern that there's certain illegal votes that were cast, it becomes easier to build momentum around resisting the result. And if it's one state that decides it, like Florida in 2000, then enormous pressure is going to be put on the electors and the administrators of that system to flip the result one way or the other. So we think it's first of all important to emphasize our system isn't broken in the sense that no matter what, it can, you know, the election can be stolen. We think it can be stolen in a case where there's a fog of war and there's enough moving parts to convince a public that there's a reason to do something extraordinary. You know, the striking fact about today is the number of people who believe the 2020 election was stolen is the same as the number of people who believed it was stolen on January 6, 2021, which means that we, you know, I don't think it was stolen. I don't think there's any evidence that it was stolen. But that is because I live in a world where I see one set of facts, and I guess other people see different sets of facts. And that reality creates the potential for this opportunity that we've written this book to identify.
I mean, but isn't there something to suggest that a super close election is, you know, it's hard to know who actually won? I mean, you know, in Bush v. Gore in 2000, if you do the count one way in Florida, Gore wins. If you do the count in another way, Bush wins. The certified result was Bush wins by 537 votes out of millions cast. I mean, it's a statistical tie. So why is this a stolen election if the scenario you're envisioning is essentially a statistical tie and the landslide election doesn't cause as many problems?
Well, I don't think 2000 was a stolen election, but it's a very illustrative election for the kind of problems we've identified. So first of all, you know, the Gore campaign made a profound mistake in conceding that everything needed to be completed by what's called Safe Harbor Day, 6 days before the electors are to cast their vote. And again, I think this is just, it was just, you know, ignorance, not stupidity, but ignorance. They just didn't know the history. Because in 1960, in Hawaii, you know, the first results from Hawaii gave the state to Nixon, and he was certified as the winner. And then the Democrats noticed tabulation errors, and so they said, we want a recount. And so they started the recount, but they realized they couldn't complete the recount before the electors would cast their votes. So they continued the recount, and the Democratic electors for Kennedy met on the same day in the same palace, the Hawaiian monarch's palace, and cast their ballots for Kennedy when the Nixon electors met and cast their ballots for Nixon. These were the first, quote, fake electors. That is how we would refer to them today. And then the results came in for Kennedy, and Kennedy was certified on, I think it's December 30th, 1960, and they immediately shipped off the certification to the Capitol so that it could be there by January 6th. Now, the point is that that reality, that way of handling ties or recounts, seems to me perfectly sensible. But they didn't allow that to happen in Florida because they all thought there was some obsessive need to resolve this 6 days before the election, which there's no obligation to under the Constitution. And it certainly was in Gore's great disfavor, because what subsequent analyses of that election showed is that if there was a full recount, which is what the Republicans were calling for, full recount in every county, Gore would have won. And if there was a targeted recount, which is what Gore was asking for, in just some of those counties, then Bush would have won. So, you know, if you just allow the system to work itself out and do, you know, a complete recount when it's so close, and let's just make sure we're really sure, you could have gotten to the right result. Now, that example, though, creates a real risk in the next election, because the rules that governed in 1960 under the Electoral Count Act have been changed by the Electoral Count Reform Act. Under the Electoral Count Reform Act, Nixon's votes would be counted, not Kennedy's votes, because the Electoral Count Reform Act says the governor has to certify 6 days before the election. There's nothing about the governor certifying after the electors have cast their ballots. And you can object to counting the governor's certified results. But the only basis for objecting is to say that the certification was improper, but, you know, Nixon was properly certified when he was certified, or the votes of the electors were, quote, not regularly given. But they were regularly given. They were given for Nixon, just like they were expected to be given. So there's, in the new law, no basis for allowing this kind of orderly recount to occur, which we think is a really profound mistake because it creates enormous incentive to slow the process down. If you are the presumptive winner, but you're anxious that the recount might actually favor the other side, you know, just delay it. And if you delay it till after the electors vote, then if the law is applied the way the law is written, there's nothing to fix it afterwards.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a big potential problem. So in the book, you mentioned seven possible strategies, and you just mentioned one, right, this delay tactic. Seven possible strategies to steal a presidential election, four of which you say probably wouldn't work, but three that could. So what keeps Larry Lessig up at night in terms of the 2024 election and the potential of it being stolen?
Well, the one that keeps me awake is one I also kind of feel a little guilty about. You know, in 2016, there were a bunch of electors from Washington and Colorado who, seeing that Trump was going to win only because he was going to have more electoral votes, but he didn't have more actual votes, thought that they should work together with Republican electors to cast their ballots for some Republican other than Trump, and therefore to throw it into the House of Representatives and give the House of Representatives a chance to decide whether it would affirm Trump as the president or pick another Republican as the president. Nobody expected they would pick Hillary Clinton. And when they did this in Washington, they were fined $1,000 each. And in Colorado, they were kicked off as electors. And it was my view that the Constitution plainly imagined that electors had a discretion, a constitutional discretion, to actually cast their ballots as they thought appropriate. So I thought that they were completely privileged to vote however they wanted. And so I volunteered to take their case to the Supreme Court, and we got into the Supreme Court. And in, I think it's May of 2020, sitting in my office, because it was the first week of remote arguments, sitting on a phone, they didn't even have Zoom, was arguing the case to the Supreme Court, arguing that, in fact, these electors were constitutionally free. They couldn't be controlled by state legislatures. But the court decided 9-0, essentially, that state legislatures had the power to tell electors how they must vote. Okay, so here's the scenario that's most terrifying to me. Imagine a very, very close election. Let's say Wisconsin's a great example here, because the legislature in Wisconsin is still a very gerrymandered legislature. They've just changed the rules, but that won't have any effect in this election cycle. So you can imagine the legislature looks at the results and says, look, we don't actually believe that, let's say, Biden is declared the winner, but it's extremely close. Let's say we don't actually think Biden was the winner. We think there's too much fraud or too many bad ballots, or they had these drop boxes they shouldn't have had or whatever. And so what they do is pass a law or a resolution, depending on your view of the constitutional power of state legislatures, that says the electors from Wisconsin must vote for Donald Trump. Now, under the rule of the Supreme Court, that law is valid. And the Supreme Court said that electors have, quote, themselves no rights, end quote. So if you're a Biden elector and you're told you must vote for Trump, your choice is either to resign or vote for Trump. And if you resign, they'll replace you with a Trump elector. So this is a strategy which the court has opened up that I don't think anybody intended. And maybe if I'd been more persuasive, we could have like gotten the court to go the other way. But it creates this strategy, this opportunity that nobody had really thought of before, because it wasn't really an option before. And that's the one that I'm actually most fearful could be deployed in a strategic way to flip the results.
So I'm with you in terms of I'm afraid of this as well if this happened before the election, right? If today, or if on, you know, October 30th, the Wisconsin legislature passed a law that said, we hereby declare our Electoral College votes go to Donald Trump. I think there's nothing in the Constitution that would prevent that. I'm not yet convinced by your argument that if the Wisconsin legislature did this after the people have voted in Wisconsin, that there would not be a successful due process challenge here. So what I'm imagining is, you know, the, you know, in November 15th or whatever, Wisconsin legislature says, you know, we don't care that the state voted for Biden. We're going to award our elect, or we're going to require the electors to vote for Trump even if the Biden electors are the ones that are appointed. Wouldn't this raise a due process challenge in that the state has allowed people to vote and now they're taking it away by not crediting what the people voted for?
Well, first, the state would never say Biden won, but we're going to flip the results. What the state would say is the results are so unsure and complicatedly messy that we don't think that there's any will expressed by what the people did in the vote. And so therefore, we're going to express what we think the will of the people in Wisconsin is. And in North Carolina and Texas, both had laws that effectively gave the state legislature in Texas, the governor or the state legislature in North Carolina, the power to do exactly that. But secondly, I do think that if you had time to litigate the question, I don't know whether it would be due process or the First Amendment or, you know, just a reinterpretation of the Cefalo case, the case that originally interpreted the power of the state legislature to control how electors vote. I don't know what the basis would be. I'm quite sure the court would find a way to stop the legislatures from doing that. But again, the timing here is so critical because, you know, let's say that the state legislature passes this in the first week after the election, or that would be even stupid. Let's say that they pass that rule a couple days before the Electoral College is supposed to vote. Okay, so, you know, you're a law professor. Tell me how quickly the Supreme Court can take this case up and then resolve it. And if they don't resolve it before the electors vote, again, under the Electoral Count Act right now, there's no basis for objecting to how the electors would be voting. One big theme in our book is if we lived in a time where we could trust the good faith of everybody, I don't think it would matter because, you know, they would do the right thing. They'd like figure the right thing out, just like Nixon oversaw the counting of Hawaii in 1961, and Nixon decided to give the electoral votes to Kennedy because that was just the right thing to do. But the whole point of where we are right now is if everybody's playing constitutional hardball and you're doing whatever you can to save the union, and both sides think that they're trying to save the union, then there'll be a real temptation to just play the rules exactly as they're written, and the Electoral Count Act of the Electoral Count Reform Act of 2022 doesn't give any easy way to fix this problem.
So what do we do now between now and, you know, November or now and January 6, 2025?
Well, I think one really great thing is we lay out these scenarios, four of which we think are plausible. What we need is people like you and other like leading figures in like the legal academy and in the public sphere to begin to talk about how to resist them or why they're wrong or why this isn't, in fact, how we ought to be running an election, so that the playbooks are set and set in advance clearly enough so we know how to resist this kind of problem if it comes up. I think that's the most we can do. You know, we're not going to get a case in the Supreme Court to resolve this before the election. There's just no standing to raise that kind of claim. And, you know, I think that even if you did get it in the Supreme Court, the court is, I think, now increasingly allergic to getting close to deciding these kinds of questions. So it would try to avoid it. And so I think that what we've been trying to do in the book and more generally is just to get people to focus on what is the weakness in this system and what understanding and will do we have to build in response to that to make sure that the results are not contrary to what they should be. And we think what they should be is take the votes in every state, find the winner, allocate the electoral votes according to that, and the electoral winner then should be president. Whether that's the person who won the popular vote or not, our rule says the electoral count winner should be president.
Mm-hmm. Final question for you, because we're talking a lot about the presidential election. Why should people even bother voting? You know, in a state like Kentucky or a state like Massachusetts or California or Texas, where the result seems preordained. What's the point? Why should people who are listening even bother going out to vote?
Yeah, you should be really angry in Kentucky, just like we should be really angry in Massachusetts and people in California and Texas the same. Because, you know, as crazy as people consider the idea of like a legislature declaring what the results will be in advance, you know, if the Wisconsin legislature said on October 30th, as you said, this state will go for Donald Trump, people would think that's outrageous because we're supposed to have elections. But in effect, all but about eight states in the United States have decided who's going to win in advance because they allocate electors according to something called the winner-take-all rule, meaning if you get just a plurality of votes, you get all the electors in your state. So in 1992, Bill Clinton got 37% of the vote in Nebraska, and he got all the electoral votes in Nebraska because they had a winner-take-all system in 1992. So the point is that we have systems in the states to basically make irrelevant these states in presidential elections. No Republican candidate would spend any time in Wisconsin, in Kentucky, or in Massachusetts, because in Kentucky, they know they already won. In Massachusetts, they know they're never going to win. And same thing with a Democrat. No Democrat would spend time in Kentucky. She's never going to win in Kentucky, and wouldn't spend any time in Massachusetts because you know you're going to win in Massachusetts. And what academics have demonstrated is these non-swing states lose in federal regulations, in federal funding compared to the swing states. Like, what the candidates are worried about is making sure Michigan and Wisconsin and Nevada and Arizona are happy. And if they're going to do whatever they can to make sure that those swing states are happy. And that's a completely ridiculous way to run a presidential election. We basically outsource our choice for president to six states, which are not representative of America at all, simply because of the way state legislatures allocate electoral votes. And that could be different. That's not in the Constitution. We could change that tomorrow, but there isn't yet a recognition of just how crazy this is. And so we live with this system where six states are going to decide who the next president will be.
Yeah. Professor Larry Lessig of Harvard Law School is the author with Matthew Seligman of How to Steal a Presidential Election. Larry, thank you so much for joining Democracy Optimist.
Thanks for having me.
So, Josh, you talked with Lawrence Lessig about the Electoral Count Act, and I think a lot of us are confused about this. How did this come about in the first place?
Yeah, so Congress passed the Electoral Count Act of 1887 after the close and hotly contested election in 1876 between Samuel Tilden and Rutherford B. Hayes. Congress had realized that there was no sound mechanism in place to resolve the disputed election, which actually involved four different states, a dispute in four different states that the commission Congress created said Hayes won all four to win the election. But after that happened, Congress realized it needed a better mechanism, so it enacted the Electoral Count Act to offer detailed procedures. As I said during the interview with Professor Lessig, the law is extremely complex and convoluted. And it's those complexities that President Trump and some of his supporters sought to exploit in 2020. Well, you might think Congress can't do really anything in a bipartisan way these days, but at the end of 2022, Congress passed the Electoral Count Reform Act to update this law. The updates include two major changes, among other tweaks. First, the law raises the threshold to pause the count and trigger debate about a state's electoral count votes to one-fifth of each house. In 2020, an objection required just a single member of each house, which, as you'll recall, at least one member of the House and one member of the Senate used to object to the electoral count votes in places like Arizona and Pennsylvania. Now the law would require one-fifth of each house. Second, the law explicitly states that the vice president's role while presiding over the joint session shall be limited to performing solely ministerial duties. Again, this means that you can't ask the vice president to make a substantive decision not to count certain electoral votes from states, as President Trump had tried to get Vice President Biden, Vice President Pence to do. These two reforms take away some of the most significant ways in which President Trump and his supporters sought to change the results in 2020. Let's hope there are not other vulnerabilities in the system in 2024.
Okay, let's get another fun election fact.
You might wonder how one becomes an elector in the Electoral College. Who are these people? Well, if we look at the Constitution, Article 2, Section 1 simply states that electors cannot be a member of Congress or hold any federal office. Under the 14th Amendment, electors also can't be anyone who has, quote, engaged in insurrection or rebellion against the United States or given aid or comfort to its enemies, which is the same language in controversy over whether President Trump was eligible to run for president in 2024. The Constitution says the state legislators determine the manner of choosing the state's electors, and all states now let the voters decide. In 48 states, the winner of the statewide vote receives all of the state's electoral votes, while Maine and Nebraska split the Electoral College votes by congressional district. But again, who exactly are these people? The states defer this selection of the actual people to the political parties. Most commonly, a slate of electors is nominated and confirmed by a vote at the statewide political party convention. Generally, the party members selected to be electors are party leaders and officials who are well connected with the right people. So when you vote for president, you're actually voting for electors, real people who are pledged to vote for that candidate when the electors meet in mid-December. By the way, while some states require the electors to vote for the candidate who won the statewide popular vote, other states leave the choice open to the electors, which raises the possibility of so-called faithless electors, as Professor Lessig discussed.
And give us another thing we can do to support democracy.
Better informed voters create a better democracy. So maybe you want to know who exactly are the electors from your state. The National Archives website has this information for previous elections. Go to www.archives.gov/electoral-college, and toward the bottom, click on See Who My State's Electors Are. That will give you a chart that has links for each state with the official certificates of electors. You can find the official Electoral College submissions that each state sends to Congress for tallying on January 6th after each election year.
Thanks for joining us for this series of conversations about how elections work, about the value of your vote, and about challenges to your right and freedom to make choices at your local polling place. Find our series online at democracyoptimist.com. Joshua Douglas, writer and host, Mike Savage, executive producer. I'm Tom Martin, your series producer. Neil Kesterson, technical director and sound designer. Democracy Optimist theme song, American, by Madeline Peru. Mason Graber and Stephen Dabney, research assistants. Caitlin Douglas, graphic designer. Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. Democracy Optimist is a special Eastern Standard series produced by Dynamics Productions for Richmond, Kentucky-based public radio station WEKU.